Okay. Right, good morning. Good morning, everybody. We can start now. My name is David Uzzell. I'm one of the co-investigators on the Resolve project, and I'll be chairing this first session on Beyond Behaviour. It's a great pleasure to be here and to see so many of you interested in this area. We've decided to organise this session around a number of sort of theoretical and methodological issues which have served to inform our research on the Resolve project, that have provided sort of multiple complementary and critical perspectives on sustainable consumption. I think it's true to say that one of the most stimulating aspects of the Resolve project is not only the fact that it is a multidisciplinary project, but it's also interdisciplinary, and there is an important distinction between the two. And I think personally for me, and I know for my colleagues, that working with some of the other disciplines has been one of the most enjoyable and stimulating aspects of the project over the last 3 years. And something of that is captured in the organisation of the symposium today, because the symposium really does reflect the coming together of two disciplines, primarily that of psychology and sociology. And that, of course, is reflected in the speakers over these two sessions. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce the first speaker, who is Linda Steeg from the University of Groningen in the Netherlands. It's a really great pleasure to invite Linda here. Linda comes from a department which has a long track record of doing work on the environment. It's really one of the centres for environmental psychological research in Europe and beyond. And Linda herself, as you can see from the notes in the programme, has got a very distinguished record in this area. I'm not going to say any more, but just to hand you over to Linda. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Well, I've been asked to tell you something about my research, but also within a framework of using methods. And my presentation will be on the use of quantitative methods. And I will focus on the theoretical perspective I take is normative concerns, because I think normative concerns are very important motivation for pro-environmental behavior. Why is this the case? Well, many pro-environmental actions, at least now, are associated with higher cost. If you want to act pro-environmentally, it means that you have to make more effort, you have to pay higher prices, it's less comfortable. In many cases, this is the case. Not always, but in many instances, it is still the case. So when you, in those cases, want to promote pro-environmental behavior, you cannot focus on that people can gain something about it or from it, or that people get pleasure from it, but you have to focus on morality. So it means that people need to benefit the environment, even though this might be associated with higher costs for themselves, at least in the short term. And that does not mean that you should not focus on cost motivations or pleasurable aspects at all, but if you need to focus on morality, at least in some instances. And let me not go into this further. Morality is an important aspect. And one of the theories in environmental psychology that's often used to explain why people engage in actions that are not profitable for them in the short term is the norm activation model. And there are different interpretations of the norm activation model. The model has been developed, proposed by Shalom Schwartz already in the 1970s. And originally it was proposed to explain pro-social behavior. For example, whether people want to donate their kidney or something like that. But in the 19th and also the 1990s, but especially later on, the model has often been used to explain pro-environmental behavior as well. And there's a clear theory about which factors influence environmental behavior, but what's not as clear is how these factors are related. And if you have a close look at the literature, you see three different types of models that appear and that are tested in the literature. First of all, some people propose the moderator model. And I explain the main concepts now as well. The general idea is that people engage in pro-environmental behavior when they feel a moral obligation to do so. And a feeling of moral obligation is called personal norm. So that's why I indicated PN. And the other key concepts in the theory of Swartz are ascription of responsibility and awareness of consequences. Awareness of consequences means that you should be aware of the fact that your problems causes problem, that your behavior causes problems for the environment. And ascriptions of responsibility means that you ascribe responsibility to yourself for these problems. That are the key concepts. And everyone agrees on that. But what the disagreement is about how these are related. So one of the models proposes that personal norms influence behavior, but that this is only the case when people are aware of the problems and when they ascribe responsibility to the problems. So the relationship between personal norms and behavior is only strong when both awareness of consequences and ascription of responsibility are high. That's the first model. But other models that appear in the literature more follow reasoning of the mediator model. And the first of these is proposes that personal norm influences behavior and that personal norms are activated when people are aware of the consequences and whether they when they ascribe responsibility for these consequences to themselves. And the final model is quite similar, but the only difference is that this model assumes that people should first be aware of the problems, then they get going to start thinking about their own responsibility in this regard, then personal norms are activated, and that finally results in behavior. Well, as there is already a clear model, a clear theory, only the relationships between the key concepts are not very clear. But because the model, the theory is already in place, we can use quantitative methods to study whether these relationships can indeed be found and which of these models is most plausible in this respect. And that's what we did in a series of studies. And our hypothesis was that the lower model would be the most plausible because in my view, or in our view, I did it together with some of my co-workers, the people should first be aware of the problems because if you are not aware of the problems, why in the first place should you ever think about your own responsibility in this respect? So you only start thinking about whether you're responsible for doing something about it when you're aware of the problem. And only if you are aware of the problems and think that you should do something about it, then you develop feelings of moral obligation to do something about it. So then personal norms are activated and that results in behavior. So we thought that the lower model would be the most plausible, theoretically. So the aim of the study, as I said, we use quantitative methods because we already know which are the key variables. We don't start from scratch on. We wanted to know which how the key variables in the norm activation model would be related. And we use correlational and experimental designs to test these relationships. And I will tell you something about both types of designs in a minute. And our dependent variables were not only pro-environmental behavior, but also pro-social behavior. Like I said, the norm activation model was originally developed to explain pro-social behavior. And in our view, pro-social and pro-environmental behavior have things in common because in both cases, you do something for others or the environment, even if it's associated with higher costs for yourself. So we wanted to include both dependent variables to see whether our results can generalize across different domains. Now, first, very briefly about the methods that we used. Correlational design, that means that you do, for example, a questionnaire study. You ask people about all the key variables, and you correlate these variables. You look for relationships between the variables. So you examine relationships between independent and dependent variables, but because you measure everything at the same time, you're not sure about causality, because you know that there's a relationship, for example, between personal norm and behavior, but you don't know for sure whether personal norms cause behavior or whether people adapted their personal norms to their behavior. You never, mostly you're not sure when you use correlational designs about causality. There are some exceptions. For example, if I would look at the relationship between temperature and aggression, then I'm pretty sure the temperature causes aggression and not the other way around. Okay, experimental designs. What you do in this case is you systematically vary the independent variable, like in our case, awareness of consequences, and then examine how the independent variable influences your dependent variables. And your dependent variable might be pro-environmental actions in this case. And a very important feature of experimental designs is that it's random assignments. So you only systematically vary the independent variable. Whether someone is in the low awareness of consequences conditions or the high environmental awareness of consequence conditions is purely by chance. It's random. So if you find an effect, you're pretty sure the effect can be attributed to your manipulation and not to any other variable because people have been randomly assigned to conditions. So by this way, you can test causality. Because if people's behavior changes because of your manipulation, you're pretty sure that your manipulation causes this effect. But a disadvantage of experimental design is mostly that external validity of your results is mostly lower than in the correlational design. But we employed both research designs because we thought both have their strengths and weaknesses, but together they give you a comprehensive view of what's going on. So very briefly on research design, I also indicated quasi-experimental studies in here, but I won't talk about it. Experiments are very strong in testing causality, but external validity is usually lower, while field studies, correlational studies, are usually very weak in testing causality, but strong in external validity. And if you use both, you have the advantages of both methods. So, which method you should use? Well, of course, each research method has its drawbacks and its strengths. And which method you choose depends on the goal of the study. But as I said, combination of different methods is most likely to yield comprehensive insights. So let's now go into the studies. Like I said, we wanted to test causal relationships between the variables in the norm activation model. We started with a correlational design. And in the studies in which we followed the correlational design, we were especially interested in comparing the moderator model with the lower mediation model. So we wanted to know whether personal norms only influence behavior when awareness of consequences and ascription of responsibility are both high, or whether it's more likely that awareness of consequences influences ascription of responsibility, which in turn activates personal norms, which results in behavior. The studies following the experimental design, we wanted to compare both mediator models. So does awareness of consequences influence personal norms independently or via ascription of responsibility? Yes, and the hypothesis I already explained, because I already explained what model was most plausible for us. Well, the correlational design. I will go into more detail in the first study, and the later studies I will only present the general picture because we don't have time to discuss all studies in depth. So the first study was a questionnaire study among a sample of people in the city of Groningen. The dependent variable was acceptability of energy policies. Awareness of consequences was measured like are people aware of the problems related to energy use. Ascription of responsibility reflected whether people felt responsible for doing something about it. And personal norm was a moral obligation to save energy. And these concepts could be clearly distinguished in this study. What we found in this study is that the mediator model was supported. The ascription of responsibility mediated the relationship between awareness of consequences and personal norms. And personal norms, in turn, mediated the relationship between ascription of responsibility and acceptability. And in both cases, full mediation was true. And more importantly, we did not find support in this study for the moderator model. Well, we did 5 studies in total, and in brief, the main conclusions of the studies 2 to 5. We followed the same procedure, and we included 5 different dependent variables: acceptability of doubling car cost, willingness to take action to reduce emissions of particulate matters, intention to demonstrate against the establishment of a methadone point, intention to donate blood, and whether people actually registered as a blood donor. We had different samples. We did the study in different countries. We did it with citizens of Groningen, also student samples. And in all studies, the mediator model was supported. All studies revealed the same picture. This model fits the data. And in all studies, we found little support for the moderator model. We found no support for the model moderator model in 2 additional studies. In study 2, we found that awareness of consequences only moderated the relationship between personal norms and acceptability, but only a very little percentage of variance was explained, and the results were in contrast to the prediction by Swartz, because we found that the relationship between personal norms and acceptability of doubling car costs would be stronger for people with a low awareness of consequences. And that's in contrast to the expectation. In the 4th study, we found that both description of awareness of consequences and description of responsibility moderated the relationship between personal norms and intention to demonstrate against the establishment of a methadone point. But again, low percentage of the variance explained, and again, the relationships were completely the opposite direction than what we expected. In study 5, we only found that description of responsibility moderated the relationship between personal norm and the registration for blood donation, but not the intention, only whether people registered. And in this case, the moderator effect was in line with our prediction. So, conclusions based on the correlational designs, we found consistent support for the mediator model, and the support for the moderator model was highly inconsistent. It was not found for 3 or out of the 6 dependent variables. Only a small percentage of the variance was explained, and the direction of the moderator effect was not consistent as well. Now, briefly about the experimental design. We did 3 studies in total. In the first study, we only manipulated the awareness of consequences to see whether awareness of consequences indeed influences ascription of responsibility, personal norms, and the behavior. And awareness of consequences? In one condition, we stressed the problems associated with particular matters, and in the other condition, we trivialized these problems. Dependent variables, I already explained. The behavior in this case was whether people were willing to participate in actions to reduce the emissions of particulate matters in the city of Groningen. And as expected, awareness of our manipulation influenced all dependent variables in the expected direction. So in a high awareness of consequences condition, people ascribed more responsibility to themselves, felt stronger personal norms, and were more likely to demonstrate, to participate in actions. In the second study, we manipulated both awareness of consequences and ascription of responsibility. This was a questionnaire study among psychology students. This time, we manipulated awareness of consequences by stressing the negative or the positive effects of child labor, so pro-social behavior in this study, and we manipulated ascription of responsibility by stressing that actions would be either successful or not successful. And the dependent variables were personal norms and willingness to ban products produced by children. What did we found? Well, as expected, again, if the manipulation of awareness of consequences had the expected effect, when people are more aware of the consequences, they ascribe more responsibility to themselves, they have stronger personal norms, and they're less likely to buy products produced by children. And, more importantly, as expected, the manipulation of ascription of responsibility did influence personal norms and behavior, but not awareness of consequences. So, better people were ascribed responsibility to themselves, they had a stronger personal norms and a higher willingness to ban products produced by children, but their awareness of consequences was not influenced by this manipulation, which supports our third mediator, the third model, the mediation model. Well, in the third study, I will not go into depth in this, but we did a similar study. We again manipulated awareness of consequences and ascription of responsibility. This time, intention to demonstrate was the dependent variable, and the results were replicated. We found the same pattern of results. So, overall conclusions, this is my last slide. We found no support and very consistent support for the mediator model, following correlational as well as experimental designs. So both types of research designs, we feel that this model was supported best by the data. So people should first be aware of the problems, then they start thinking about what they self can do about it. When both are strong, people develop a feeling of moral obligation to do something about it, and then they actually act. The correlational design revealed the relationships between the variables, and because we examined people in their natural situation with the external validity of this, these studies is quite high, and a causality could be established via the experimental design. So both together convincingly show in our view that this model is the most plausible one. And final slide, I did not do this on my own, of course, collaborate with these people. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Linda. I think as time is moving on, we will perhaps gather questions at the end and try and give some time to the average discussion amongst.
Yep.
I might say ignore the green movement, but perhaps look less to the green movement. But we've clearly been heavily influenced by the orange movement, because Birgitta too hails from Groningen originally, although she's been at Surrey now for the last 10 years or so. Birgitta has a number of interests in sustainable consumption, but one of the principal interests over the last few years has been its relationship to materialism, and it's on that subject that she will be speaking, partly at least, this morning. Birgitta.
Thank you. Can everybody hear me? Is this on? Actually, I can't hear that myself. Okay, thank you very much. I'm Birgitta Katzleb. I'm one of the co-investigators of the Resolve project. And as David said, I will tell you something about some studies we've done on materialism and environmental concern. Now, of course, we all know what Resolve stands for, research on lifestyles, values and the environment. So some of the work that we've been doing addresses specifically that relationship between values and lifestyles. And this talk today I'll try to be very quick, so I'll race through it, will specifically be on values and lifestyles. And I'll first define some of the concepts, pose some research questions, and present some findings of several correlational studies that we've done. So just like some of the work that Linda showed you, these studies that we've done are all survey studies that have where we look at correlation, so we can't draw any causal conclusions. Why focus on environmental materialism and environmental concern? Well, of course, there's lots of different values that people hold, so we have decided we are not going to look at the whole value pattern. There's lots of people who have developed wonderful overviews of different values that people hold, like Schwartz, for instance. And we've decided to focus specifically on materialism and environmental concern for two reasons, really. One is, of course, those are the most obvious and logical ones that could be related to consumer behavior and have been shown to be related to consumer behavior. But the second reason, really, is that because if you look at the literature on these two different concepts, they come from very different traditions. And the traditions that bring these two concepts together, there seems to be very much an indication or a suggestion that they are sort of opposite concepts, one driving consumption up, the other one driving consumption down. And this sort of stems from the Engelhardt tradition, which showed that in modern Western societies, values have changed from more materialistic to more post-materialistic. And that is related to Maslow's ideas of needs hierarchy, so the idea that we are not going to be concerned about the environment if we don't have anything to eat. So we first need to satisfy our own basic materialistic needs before we can think about others and the world around us. And even in the sort of newer work, the modern work by Schwartz, for instance, who suggests that values can be clusters along 10 motivational domains and then can be plotted on, along two dimensions, self-transcendence and versus self-enhancement and openness to change versus conservatism. The idea of self-enhancement versus self-transcendence has also that dichotomy in it. So self-enhancement is more egoistic values, more materialistic values, whereas on the other hand, you've got self-transcendence, which is more about social, environmental, and universal values. And that sort of reflects also in some of the more specific studies that have looked at materialism or studies that have looked at environmental concern, which basically show that people who are more materialistic or have more stronger materialistic value orientations tend to have lower intentions to behave pro-environmentally, whereas environmental concern is positively related to environmental behavior. There are, however, some studies now also that suggest that this might not be true at all. These two concepts are not dimension one, have not got one underlying dimension. And a recent paper have looked specifically at post-materialism as Ingerhardt's values and environmental concern and found that there isn't really one underlying dimension. And even some of the work in Ingerhardt and Maslow have themselves suggested maybe it's not that straightforward. So what we wanted to do in this study is to look at that in more detail. In relation to the concept of sustainable lifestyles, I've just plonked these two lovely quotes on here, and of course there's many more quotes I could have put on here, but it's just to indicate that we all know that the concept of sustainable lifestyles is a really big concept. Everybody strives for this idea about sustainable lifestyles. That's our goal. But the question, of course, is what is a sustainable lifestyle? We've had many discussions in the Resolve project with all the different researchers, and I might disappoint some of you to say that I'm not going to give you any answers and I'm not going to give you a definition today, because it is one of those concepts that we can probably discuss for days if we wanted to. The only thing pointed I guess I would like to make is that it involves more than intentional pro-environmental behaviour. And Linda gave some examples of some of the studies that she's done and referred to some other work as well. And one of the things that particularly within social science and particularly within psychology, most of the studies that look at sort of sustainability issues look at intentional pro-environmental behaviour, in behaviour that you adopt with the intention of doing something good for the environment, like recycling. There's no real rational other reason to recycle other than for the sake of the environment. But of course, there's a lot of things that we do in our day, in our daily life, and a lot of things we buy, a lot of activities that have an impact on the environment, but we don't necessarily link to environmental issues. So we wanted to basically explore a sort of a broader package of behaviours, so to speak. So the questions that I'm going to address are how are environmental concern and materialism related, if at all, and how are both of these concepts related to various lifestyle variables. And the data that we're using for this are data from five different studies. The first one is a study that we're doing with the Eden Project, which is called the 21st Century Living Project. Some of you might have heard of it. It's a year-long longitudinal study with 100 UK households. And we did a survey with these people, all the participants of this study, 16 and over, in August last year. We're going to do another one in coming August. The other study was done a few years ago in the Resolve project, which sent a survey to randomly selected households in two areas in the UK. And we also did a series of survey studies among young people in the UK, in Spain, and in China. If anybody has any intention of collecting data in China, I can highly recommend it. We had a student who went over to China, came back a month later with nearly 1,000 completed questionnaires, whereas we were struggling to get 300. So the things that there's lots of different things that we measured in these questionnaires, but two of the things that we measured were materialism and we used sort of existing measures of these concepts, materialism and environmental concern, and various lifestyle variables, and we specifically looked at intentional pro-environmental behaviour, but also at the time people spent on various activities and the indications of how important certain consumer products are to people. And the young people questionnaires were slightly shorter, so the measures are not exactly the same between the two types of questionnaires. But the ideas are very similar. So the first thing, the relationship between values, well, basically what we found, which is very consistent with lots of other studies, is we found a small negative significant correlation between the two concepts, which suggests that people who are stronger, have stronger materialistic values, are slightly less slightly more likely to have weaker environmental concern. But the correlation is only 0.20, which suggests that there's only 4% shared variance between these concepts. So you can't really conclude on the basis of that they are opposite ends of one dimension. They're related, but they're not the same. And just to show you in a different way, this is the percentage of people who have relatively high and relatively low scores on the materialism and environmental concern scale. And you should see there's almost a quarter of the respondents say that they are both have strong materialistic values and strong environmental concern. Interestingly, we found no correlation at all in the Chinese sample, and I still need to explore why this might be. So the three different behaviour variables, the first one is intentional pro-environmental behaviour, so people's intention to drive less, use recycled paper, buy organic food, and there's a range of questions that we include. Here I just sort of presented the sort of average across all these behaviours. So basically what we found that was that, as expected, environmental concern and materialism had the opposite effect on intentional pro-environmental behaviour, which is very similar to what other studies have found as well. There was a slight difference between adults and young people, though, where for young people the relationship between environmental concern and intentional pro-environmental behaviour was much stronger than for adults. And you can see these are the results of a regression analysis, so the percentage of explained variance was also much higher for young people, which would suggest that younger people are more likely to sort of act in accordance to their values. But having said that, of course, younger people have different types of behaviours, they have different decisional power, and of course we had different types of questions. So the questions for the younger people were often related to sort of easier behaviours, like using recycled paper, whereas for adults there were questions about reducing your car use, for instance, so that could have something to do with it. In terms of the other questions that we looked at, so time spent on various activities, one of the things that we found was that there was a relationship between materialism and the time that people said they spent on various activities, but not with environmental concern at all. And we specifically, in each of these questionnaires, gave people a list with questions which had behaviours in it that require the use of energy and materials, and behaviours that don't do that. So, for instance, spending time in your garden or going for a walk or things like that, or reading a book, versus things like shopping, playing computer games, watching television. And we found that for adults, people were more likely to say that they spent time on fun shopping, playing computer games, watching television, things like that, if they had stronger materialism. For young people, we found a similar type of thing, but the relationships, again, were very weak for Chinese people. And these effects are controlled for age and gender, of course, because materialism and environmental concern tend to be different depending on age and gender. And, of course, these activities are different for age and gender. So these are controlled for age and gender, which suggests that people who have strong materialistic values tend to spend more time on activities that require the use of energy and materials, whereas environmental concern has got nothing to do with it, basically. Another question that we asked in various forms is, what consumer products do you own, or what would you like to buy if you had some money, or how would you spend your money, or how important are various consumer goods to you? So it's very much about the products themselves. And again, we found that there was a strong relationship with materialism, but not so much with environmental concern. So, for instance, just some examples of some of the findings is that we had in the adult surveys, we asked people how important are each of these consumer products for you? And there's actually 25 products or something like that. And adult materialists, so to speak, were much more likely to say that they found modern technology products important, which included a microwave, a computer, a television, things like that, whereas that was not the case for other types of products. When we asked another question, if you could drive any car for a day in your life, any car you would like, people were very likely to come up with lots of fancy ideas of fantastic cars. But there were also a group of people who said, I don't care about cars. Cars are not important. I wouldn't want to drive a car. I hate cars, things like that. And those types of comments were significantly more likely to be made by people who had low materialism, but not necessarily high environmental concern. And the question, if you could take a holiday anywhere you like in the world, people who scored high on materialism were much more likely to choose a destination which was very far away. And for the young people survey, for instance, we asked them, imagine that you won £100,000, what would you spend the money on? And young people who scored higher on materialism were much more likely to say they would buy a house or a car, and they were much less likely to donate money to charities or give it to friends or share it with friends and family. Some of you might be interesting to know, I thought it was very interesting, that about a third of the young people in our UK survey said that they would donate some of the money to charities, which I thought was quite good. But in China, it was 70% of the young people, which I thought was quite astonishing. Okay, so to conclude, and leave some time for the others. Materialism and environmentalism and environmental concern, in these correlational studies, are not necessarily inversely related. So people can hold both values at the same time, and one is positively related to consumerism and the other one is negatively related. So they have opposite impacts on behaviours, but are mostly related to different types of behaviours as well. And of course, this raises lots of questions in terms of how to promote sustainable lifestyles. Because a lot of the work that we do now is on raising awareness, promoting pro-environmentalism, and making people aware of climate change issues, for instance. But if people do accept that message, but at the other hand, they still increase their consumer behavior because they also have materialistic values, should we maybe do something else, like, for instance, making people more aware of the link between environmentalism and materialism? Or if we accept the idea that maybe values are not that easy to change, take the idea that some people are more materialistic and address those materialistic values through social marketing. So maybe make sure that the people who would like to buy more things, make sure that they buy the right things, basically. So just one last slide, really, is to say that, as we said before, this is about methods, and these are very correlational studies, and correlational studies, as Linda also suggested already, have advantages, and they have disadvantages as well. And we have a session in the afternoon, I think it's called Green or Thrifty, I think that was where we have lots of examples of more qualitative studies which could address a lot of issues that, of course, quantitative studies cannot address. Like, for instance, the advantage of survey studies is that it's easy to find large samples, so we can quantify the findings, it allows comparisons between groups, it's a relatively low cost and easy to administer. But of course, problems with causality, Linda already mentioned those, we get response problems, and it also in some way leads to a limited insight because we as researchers impose our ideas on the questionnaire, and that's the only way to do it because you can't have a questionnaire where you ask 100,000 questions, so we are limited by time and space and we test models or ideas. So I'll leave you with that thought, and hopefully you'll get some more interesting ideas this afternoon in the other session, and from Nora as well. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Birgitte. As I say, I will definitely leave time at the end for discussion. I'm very pleased now to introduce Nora Retzel from the University of Umeå in Sweden. Nora is visiting professor on the Resolve project. Nora's provided an invaluable critical input into the thinking of a lot of the research that's going on in Resolve, both at a theoretical and a methodological level, and has been actively involved in a number of projects, some of which you'll hear about in the after-the-break sessions, so the Emma White and Justin Spinney's project. So, Nora.
Yes. Thank you very much. This will be a strange presentation because the discussion was that it should be about methods. But I thought, you know, methods depend very much on the theory that you use. So I thought I would start to explain a little bit what kind of different theoretical framework I try to use, and then have a comment on what kind of methods are therefore more useful for that theoretical framework. The problem is that I will spend all the time explaining the theoretical framework and then saying only very little about the method. So I hope that's okay. But otherwise, it was a bit difficult. So I start from the idea, which is perhaps not right, but which I've got through reading through some of the literature, that there has been a failure so far to create behavior change that is long-lasting and not just lasts for as long as the project goes or so on. So there are two possible ways forward from that. One, to devise better and more elaborate strategies, which is one very good way. And the other is to examine the theoretical basis of the existing strategies and try to question perhaps that basis and try to develop an alternative theoretical framework, which is what I try to do. And the structure of the talk is I will make the point that the tragedy of the commons, which is a very widely used metaphor for the problem that we are facing with environmentally best behavior, because it is seen as a contradiction between the individual desire for enriching themselves or having a good life and the necessity to care for the common good. So I will argue that that idea is a tragedy of what I will call and explain privatized individuals. And along with, I will argue that there is no necessary contradiction between egocentrism and altruism, and that if we look at other theoretical concepts, like, for instance, critical psychology, which I will then explain in very short and dogmatic points, we could see the relationship between the individual and the common very differently, and that would also lead to a kind of different research strategies and probably different policies. So I will talk about methods, point four, and then make some very vague and general suggestions for different way of looking at these issues. So I'll start with a quote from Robert Gifford and Donald Hine introducing an experiment that they were doing where they tried to show how people react if they are to harvest something in order to enrich themselves, but at the same time know that if they harvest too much, they will produce a loss of resources for the whole community. So what I argue is that the way in which this dilemma is posed already assumes that there is a fundamental contradiction between the individual and the common interest. And if one looks at the arrangement of the experiment, that is just an example of one experiment, but there are lots of experiments like that if I go through the literature. This is the way in which the authors explain the procedure. So the most important thing about is that the individuals are put in a position, in a spatial arrangement, where they're not supposed to communicate with each other. So I think it is not surprising then that people do not communicate and do not talk about the common good, because simply they're just sitting there as individuals trying to harvest their thing without, first of all, knowing anything about the resources that they're harvesting and what happens if they harvest too much, without knowing what other people do, without having a sense of being a collective that is actually using a common good. And the only information they have about what other people say is what the leader of the experiment tells them. They tell them, the other people are doing this, so you cannot do that, and so on. So there is also a hierarchical relation here between the people who are in the experiment, these harvesters, and the knowledge that they get. So they have to trust the knowledge that comes from above, and they don't know how this knowledge came into being. So I would say very boldly and dogmatically, because I don't have the time to express that in a more complex and complicated way, which I would otherwise, of course, do, that what happened in this experiment is some kind of self-fulfilling prophecy, that you put people in the position where they act as individuals without knowing of each other, and then what you find out, surprisingly, is that they act as individuals without communicating with each other. Actually, the result is even more surprising, because the highest percentage of individuals in this experiment actually did not overharvest. They were quite careful in using the resources, even though they could not communicate about it. So the other point I want to make, which underlies these experiments, is that there is an underlying assumption that altruism and egocentrism are opposites, because altruism is defined as giving yourself up, as helping somebody else in a way that then makes it impossible for you to survive in the same way as you would have had if you hadn't helped somebody else. So the problem with this is, with this idea of the contradiction between altruism and egocentrism, is that it doesn't look at the conditions within which individuals act. It sees this contradiction between altruism and egocentrism as something that is just a human way of behavior. And I would say that this is a naturalization of the present conditions. What happens if one looks at the experiments and at the theoretical background is that a specific behavior, which is widespread today, and I would argue is widespread because of the way our society is organized, is then generalized into a general human behavior and projected into the past in order to argue that this is so-called a natural behavior. And I argue that it is a naturalization because many of the examples that are then put in the literature, in the psychological and also sociological literature, about why there is this contradiction between altruism and egocentrism, come from the animal life. For instance, in Gerald Gardner and Paul Stern books, they quote, "Imagine an individual animal living long ago that did not repeat behaviors that led to favorable immediate consequences for itself." Well, first of all, this is a fiction because individual animals don't live as individuals. Already individuals live in groups and have some kind of social life. This is another version of retrograde utopia, which I only put there so you can have a laugh in between and have a rest from the argument. So the result of this basic idea that there is a contradiction between the individual and the common and between altruism and egocentrism is that cooperation that is, of course, found all over the world at all times and in different places is then seen as a mystery. So that you have a lot of literature trying to explain hardly why on earth humans cooperate, because it seems so contradictory to any way of which you conceptualize how human beings are. So the question that one has to pose then is, why is this idea of the contradiction between the common and the individual so successful and actually so convincing? And I would argue it's convincing, of course, because although we see cooperation all around, we also see egocentric behavior all around because our societies are organized in that way. So one could then argue that if our societies are organized in that way, that then it's quite useful and sensible to have practices that are catered to or tailored to that kind of sense of individualism and egocentrism that is opposed to the commons, because we live under conditions that actually produce this kind of behavior and competition. The problem, though, is, and I would argue that that is perhaps the reason why a lot of strategies to change behavior are not so very successful in the long run, is because if you devise strategies in a way that speak to egocentrism, like, for instance, fines or giving people awards for behaving in a certain way, you kind of cement and reproduce the structure of the behavior that you really want to overcome. So you want to produce people who are more responsible environmentally and looking at the common good, but you do it with strategies that reproduce the egocentrism that actually is the problem of the whole thing. So, very short, how much minutes do I have? Five or something? Five? Okay, very shortly. Critical psychology, of course, exists as here in Britain as well and in other countries, but this is kind of a German version of critical psychology because this is where I come from. So I won't read all the points, but what it basically does is to try to understand, so it's kind of an evolutionary theory as well, but it tries to understand how the human beings come into being and what is the specificity of human beings. And what they say shortly is that human beings, of course, produce and reproduce, have to create the environment around them instead of just adapting to it, because otherwise they wouldn't survive, and they have to do it in a cooperative way. And they produce tools, and not only that, they also produce tools in order to produce tools. So they create a kind of second nature around them. And that means that evolution and development is not anymore something that happens genetically mainly, but that happens on the basis of that created second nation that people then have to adopt and develop further in specific times and places. So that means that altruism and cooperation are different things, because there is no necessary contradiction between altruism and egocentrism, because if you have to cooperate in order to survive, that means that cooperation is also in your individual interest. And there are other people in other sciences, and I quote here a Journal of Theoretical Biology, who are finding that out as well through modeling and experiments and even rational choice theory. And also in biology, there are now several books that contest the idea that even in the world of animals, evolution develops through egocentrism. And for instance, she argues that she argues theoretically against the idea that there is sexual selection, that is, that females select the male that is more beautiful and powerful in order to have that beautiful and powerful genes in their offsprings, but that instead there is something like social selection, that even in the biological world, that animals select each other because they're able to cooperate well in producing, reproducing their offspring. So just a short idea to show that this is not just a silly idea of some psychologists, but that the idea that egocentrism and altruism are opposites is contested widely these days. So what does that mean for the usefulness of qualitative research? I think qualitative research is useful in order to follow that path, because we are not necessarily interested in general behavior, in the dominant behavior. In qualitative research, not only, but it's also interesting to look at exceptions, to look at things that are not normal and general. Why? Because you can then analyze the specific social, political, material conditions within which exceptional behavior occurs, for instance, extremely cooperative behavior, and you can then think about and theorize and devise social and political practice how such an exceptional case can be generalized. So it's another concept altogether of generalization. So that means that this also produces perhaps other kind of research. Gifford argues in his last piece, well, the last one I've read, that the person has to be at the center and the start for research. And I think that's right. But the question is, what is the person? What is the individual? If we take the critical psychological approach, we would see the individual always, from the beginning, as the ensemble of the social relations within which individuals live. That is, changing individuals always means changing the social relations within which we live. And the questions that we would ask is, how do people act in real-life situations where they need to cooperate and they need to have collective action, and how can that probably be generalized? So the first conclusion would be that if we use another theoretical framework, we will not only reproduce what we already know in experiments, but we might find out new things and surprising things about cooperative, collective, and responsible behavior. And psychology could develop concepts that help people to understand their frustrations and their egocentrism, not as a result of a bad character or lacking moral, but as a result of the social situation within which they live. And then the possibility would be to change those conditions and to improve their living conditions instead of being told that they have low moral or something like that. So in devising a historical perspective that deconstructs the present relations as the taken-for-granted conditions, psychology and sociology and the social sciences could understand the way in which these conditions and these specific behaviors have come into being historically, and then through that historical analysis also question these conditions. Finally, so to be even more dogmatic, I have set out some rules. That is, if psychology wants to, that one could devise on the basis of this different theoretical framework, if psychology wants to change behavior, it should enable people to change the conditions that sustain environmentally damaging behavior, and through such practices change themselves as well. Instead of telling people how to solve the environmental crisis, psychology could devise concepts that enable people to find and realize their own solutions, and instead of devising behavior change strategies for people, one could look at already existing changing practices and aim to support, broaden, and generalize them, because, of course, there is a lot of that around already. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Nora. We've got at least 5 minutes for questions. I know we're due to finish at 11:35, but I think intellectual sustenance is far more important than material sustenance, so we will extend another 5 minutes. So, are there any questions for anyone on any of the speakers this morning?
Question for Laura, is it in the middle? Sorry. Thanks for your presentation. It was very interesting. I was wondering how you measure how materialistic someone is. So you said people with low and high materialism, but I was slightly confused what that might mean. Could I take a little test to find out how materialistic I am?
I basically used the existing agenda of this work. Does it
matter? Not very well.
By Richens and Dawson in 94 or something, which basically is a set of 12 questions which asks things like, my life would, to what extent do you agree with these statements, my life would be better off if I had more things, or if I earned more money, or I like sharing things with other people. So it's very much the extent to which people find it important to surround themselves with more materialistic things to and think that that will make them happy and they can express their status and identity through material objects.
Okay. So that. And whose theory is that based upon?
Sorry?
The kind of selection of particular questions, is that based upon a particular theorist?
I think the work started in the 70s. There's been quite a lot of work on materialism and to develop to develop these scales, and it's got several underlying dimensions, these scales, non-generosity, possessiveness. So yeah, there's a lot of literature out there that has developed these scales, and the theories about materialism are quite interesting because there's a huge debate on why some people are more materialistic than others, or why that might lead to a lower well-being, and whether it's something that you learn through your life, you're exposed to more material values and objects through advertisement, or whether it's a personality characteristic, or so there are various discussions still around there and theories around there why some people are more materialistic than others. I won't give you my view yet.
Hello, good afternoon, or good morning, rather. I'm Claudia Costanza from Wastewatch, and I was really fascinated by all the three presentations. It's really a lot of food for thought. And I have about 10 questions, but I'll only ask one. Really, what I was very interested in was the point that was raised about intentional pro-environmental behaviour as opposed to pro-environmental behaviour that just happens, or also anti-environment behaviour that happens as a result of our daily actions and as a result of acting within in a system that actually locks us into behaviours. I mean, that's often talked about, the behavioural lock-in. So my question was really to the panel, what should be the message for our policymakers? Because most of the focus on pro-environmental behaviour seems to be at intentional pro-environmental behaviour and how we can coerce or coax people into changing their behaviour for altruistic reasons. But is there really a message to say what we should be focusing on is changing the system or enabling behaviour change in totally different ways?
Well, I mean, I'll just say quickly, but maybe we can all say something. But I guess my message is that different behaviours are influenced by different things. So the intentional pro-environmental behaviour is much more through values and norms, like what Linda suggested. And if you want to basically change lifestyle, so the whole package, you really need to adopt a range of methods. That's really, I guess, the simple answer from my perspective. Don't know.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. No, people do not act out of environmental reasons only, but I don't agree that all policies are directed at intentional behavior only, because at least in the Netherlands, there's a lot of effort being put on stimulating people to save energy in their houses, and mostly energy-related behaviors are not mainly caused by environmental reasons or by values. We both have wrote a paper on that topic as well. So in some instances, people are mainly influenced by their norms and values, and because they want to benefit the environment, but in other cases the circumstances are very important. So in that case, you should first target those situational factors to make sure that pro-environmental behavior becomes an option for people. So I agree with you, it depends on the type of behavior, which strategy is most important.
Here.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks. So now I think it's nothing wrong with all these attempts to change behavior, but I think a lot of studies already show that these changes only go so far. And I mean, if you tell people not to use the car or use less energy and you don't have the structure in place where people are able to do that, I think that is one point. So that's why I think the structures and the possibilities that exist are very necessary to change, so in order that people can change. But another thing also, and there are a lot of initiatives, is that people have to get more, like even Giddens said this, the civil society has to be strong and vibrant. That is, people have to be able to get more control over the way in which their societies and communities
are governed, so take part in this government. Because I think if you have part in the way in which your society develops, if you are part of that and you can decide about that more than just voting, which is of course also important, then I think you can develop the idea and the feeling that that is your society, and you'll be more ready and more able to change things together with other people.
Okay, time for, I think, for one more question.
Thank you. David Ockwell from the University of Sussex. Thank you. I continue to learn a huge amount from engaging with psychologists. I'm reading a lot of the psychology literature now and working with some psychologists in my own research on climate change, and particularly in public issues of public engagement with climate change. There's something I'm struggling with a little bit, though. I'm probably not going to articulate it very well because I'm struggling with it, but it seems to me that the psychological approach or the psychologist's approach to dealing with the issue of climate change and social change, behavioural change, is very much focused at the level of the individual, so the kind of epistemological approach is very individually focused. What I'm struggling with is the kind of disconnect between that and my understanding of the way we kind of construct ourselves, the way we construct our values through social engagement, through engagement with broader social discourses, what shapes those broader discourses and how that then feeds back and influences society and ourselves as individuals. I guess my question is, I mean, it seems like Nora, the kind of critical psychology approach is maybe engaging with this a bit more, but do you see that there's a disconnect? And if there is, how might we approach this? And if there isn't, why do you think that that's okay not to be focusing at that broader social level?
No, it's psychologists do focus on the individual level, that's true, but they also look at social influences on individual behavior. So that might be the connection. We also look at how the environment, how norms, how opinions of others, behavior of others influence individual behavior. So that is, in a way, is a connection. And another thing to say is that in many cases, studies on environmental behavior, sustainability, carbon low society are done with interdisciplinary teams. And in many cases, sociologists and psychologists collaborate, and that's also a link.
I was raised as a psychologist in the Netherlands, as a traditional cognitive experimental psychologist, and very much individualistic. And through my career working in multidisciplinary teams, and particularly now that we're working in Resolve, where we are working much closer with sociologists as well, I have to say I am going through a steep learning curve, particularly addressing those issues that you are saying, because I do agree that psychology, traditionally, but there's nothing wrong with that in a way. It starts off with individual, approaches an individual, asks the individual, and talks to an individual. And from my perspective, the sociology is much more likely to take the broader context into account. And I think that's the sort of the classical difference between the two disciplines. And they look at issues in a different way. And like Linda says, traditionally psychology will look at the context, but from an individual approach, or how does the individual perceive the context? Or if you change the context, how does the individual respond to it? But I do agree with what you're saying, and these are issues that we are discussing in our Resolve group as well, particularly in the team of the sociologists and the psychologists, and with people like Nora as well. And I'm still learning, so I can't really give you an answer, but it's a really difficult issue and interesting as well.
Yeah, certainly no answer either. But I started in psychology and I ended up in sociology. And I think really the way forward is that we have to take down these barriers between sociology and psychology, because a psychology that doesn't see the individual inherently as social, I mean, not only as influenced by social factors, but as a product and producing society, I think, is a problem, and I think a sociology that is always talking about structures without taking into account the way in which individuals create, see, and reproduce and also change structures is also poor. So why not, you know, join psychology and sociology into one subject?
No.
Okay, I think on that note we'll call a break. So we're not only going to solve climate change here today, we're going to restructure the disciplinary activities. This session, this symposium, this theme on theory and method continues after the break, as they say, but it will carry on in the Oxford room, which is through that room and then on the right, I believe. So please do come back for the second half. Thank you very much indeed. And thank you to our speakers.